that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Blue railroad train, a good old pal to me. Take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. Today is Sunday, December the 15th, 2019, and this is the Prairie Monk program, WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, soon to be whiteways. It looks like we're almost guaranteed to get inches on the ground of snow by the end of today. But at any rate, the trails and things will still be out there underneath the snow, and whatever else Dave has been up to for this last week.
Well, you had an announcement for...
If you're willing to let me get it out of the way right off the top. Yes, we actually have a PSA for a place that's near and dear to my heart. I guess I should mention that I actually work at the Orpheum Children's Museum. Next Tuesday, December the 31st, from 10:30 in the morning to 1:30 in the afternoon, the Orpheum will have what we call our annual noonday drop, where we have a noon celebration of New Year's. Rather than making kids and their parents stay up until midnight to celebrate New Year's, we do it at noon. Come on in. We have 4,000 balloons. You can bet this coming week, I should actually be sticking to the PSA. Crazy hats, countdown to the big moment and a drop of more than 4,000 balloons at the strike of noon. Again, that's New Year's Eve, but at noon. So from 10:30 in the morning until 1:30 in the afternoon, we'll be having our noonday drop this coming Tuesday.
Rude question. Where do all the balloons end up? Do the birds eat them? Or?
Well, I'll tell you what. The museum, the theater where the balloons come down gets really, really loud for about the next 20 minutes. After the balloons come down, children usually have something they can poke with, and they pop every single one of those balloons.
Okay. So and then they pick up the plastic after.
We're stuck with it after that, the latex, whatever that is, yes.
I have things to say. I went past a dumpster, and I'm tended to look in dumpsters, and there were two quite nice office chairs. So I pulled them out and put them alongside the dumpster, which often indicates that people can take them. Came back several hours later and they were still there, so I took them to Habitat. But it reminds us that this country does not do very well with recycling. And even though that those chairs went to Habitat, that they have to recycle fairly often. That means they probably lose a third of the recycle capacity that they have. And it's difficult because some items are the sort of items that have to stay around for some time before they're recycled. The right sort of person comes in. So putting labels on materials that come in and recycling doesn't always satisfy the paradigm of trying to get people to reuse equipment and materials. Stephen Wolfram was here this week, and some of that relates to what we do, and he has an organization that uses Mathematica to help people understand the language of mathematics. If you're a philosopher, if you come across an idea and it keeps repeating, you can put a number on that idea, and gradually you get algorithms and a system of language. And not everyone is familiar with that, and not everyone can be, but an analogy is that if you want to use a car as a tool, you don't have to learn how to create the car. You need to learn how to use it. And he produced a book which give some examples of same, and he has a concern around the world of agencies that need to not only talk to children that are dreaming, but he needs to talk to the teachers who enable the children to dream. And it's a fairly young group. If you're talking about gaming, for instance, you're talking about people between 16 and 26. After that, you're starting to lose some of that verve you need to be able to dream. So we'll deal with that at another date. Today, we have a guest, and his name is Chris Stowe, and he is an engineer. He'll probably correct me on some of this, but he's also into remote sensing, and his concern and why he's here today is to talk about landfills that are located on top of areas where we drink from, like aquifers. And I was asked to go to a meeting this week, and he spoke at that, and I invited him to be here because I think we talk a lot about the Mahomet Aquifer. And so I'll let him introduce himself. I'd like him to say something about where he grew up. Some people are very local, and some people Midwestern, and some are out of state and out of country. So just a background and some idea of what you had, and then say something like what you were saying at that meeting.
Well, thank you, Dave and Dave. It's a pleasure to be here on WEFT, and thank you for the invitation to reach out to some of the viewers, or excuse me, listeners, and viewers in the local area, and anybody who might be listening online. I grew up in South St. Louis County. I was kind of got into my profession of engineering geology, and nobody knows exactly what an engineering geologist is, and the joke is it's a person who knows neither engineering nor geology. But you have to study both of those, chemistry, physics, and in my case, image processing, remote sensing. And I did research work at the University of Illinois, at the Illinois State Geological Survey for 35 years. And in my retirement, I started to take some of the work that I was doing and try to see if we can do something to help protect the drinking water, our only source of drinking water in this area.
Well, you're also a county board member, so you have a concern for the public.
Yes, Dave. I was fortunate to be elected to the county board last year, and I'm running again next year for re-election, and the county board has kind of gotten behind this idea of looking at the legacy landfills that lie over the Mahomet Aquifer, and trying to help reduce the threat of contamination from those old dumps and sanitary landfills. Let me ask you, Dave. We'll start off with a quiz. How many landfills do you think lie over the Mahomet Aquifer?
Well, I have a rough idea that it services about 14 towns and 80,000 people, and I'm not quite sure how many landfills there are on top of it, but I know there's one, a very large one at Clinton, and then there are a whole bunch of little cemeteries and places that have been landfills associated with small towns. So I would guess at least probably 40 if you go from Danville through to Springfield and Beardstown. It might be even more than that, that are sort of heritage landfills.
Yes, that's a good term. And cemeteries of waste is a very good descriptor for these old dumps and sanitary landfills. And it turns out that there's 218 landfill complexes of landfills that include dumps and later landfills and sanitary landfills that lie over the Mahomet Aquifer, and about half of those lie over shallow aquifers mapped within 20 feet of the land surface. So that means that if a community and every town had a dump or sanitary landfill until the 1970s or 80s, but they'd oftentimes dig down 6 feet, 10 feet, 12 feet into the ground to bury the waste. And so that means that those landfills are so much closer to those shallow buried aquifers that may be connected to the deeper Mahomet.
Yes, some of these small landfills are in streams where they fill in the valley. And that's even worse because it's on the surface and it's runoff, and you can pick up scungy materials. There are also borrow pits around where land has been taken out to provide for a highway or something like that. And that's a very tempting place to dump strange materials.
You're right, Dave. Oftentimes, former sand and gravel pits and quarries were holes in the ground, even sinkholes in some parts of Illinois in the Midwest, were available holes in the ground that people could dispose of waste. And oftentimes, unfortunately, these are wastes that we no longer allow to be discarded into modern landfills. They'd include DDT, agricultural chemicals, industrial chemicals, household waste, and things that, as I said, would have to be found to be discarded into a more safe place than a common municipal landfill. So these wastes actually may pose a threat to our water source, and that's part of the reason that I took on this project.
I could think of a landfill at Arcola, which took a lot of sludge from Chicago, heavy metals included, and then the wildlife takes up those materials. They like the swamp or the ponds there, and then that spreads around. If you hunt a duck and eat the duck, you end up with some of these materials in your body and in your brain.
Well, you're quite right, Dave. This is plants take up some of these materials. I haven't seen studies of plants taking up organic materials, but we know that they take up inorganic chemicals. And if these are browsed by animals, deer, domestic animals, cattle, that might find its way into our own food system, and we would consume that, of course.
Yes. So, is this a state issue or is it a local issue? When does this become a federal issue?
Well, that's a very good question, David. The state of Illinois is one of the first to take up the issue of the 3,430 legacy landfills, or what you call heritage landfills, that are all over the state of Illinois. And thanks to a recent public law, 101-0573 that was passed in this recent legislative General Assembly, the Illinois EPA is beginning to start looking at some of these historic old landfills that have not been inspected very well and oftentimes not maintained. And the first place that they're going to start looking, as I understand, is going to be over the Mahomet Aquifer.
Yes. At the federal level, there are Superfund places where there have been large landfills that need to be looked at seriously, and we have one of those in Danville area.
That's right, David. And it's unfortunate that some of these old landfills, I had a chance to visit some of them up in Chicago with George Roadcap. Some of these former Superfund sites get repaired, or as best that they can be repaired, with a new cover, which is very, very expensive. But unfortunately, there's no maintenance, continuing maintenance of these, and they're, after the construction, a new cap is put on, they're largely abandoned, and materials erode, exposing the vinyl cover or the plastic cover, or if it's just an earthen cover, the depressions form, erosion occurs, and the problem starts to problems and defects develop in the landfill cover, and this is the focus of my work.
Yes, again in Danville, there's a material that comes from a fly ash from that is on the banks of the river, and that can slump into the river and destroy a reasonably pristine river.
You're right, David. Oftentimes, these town dumps were not just kind of gravel pits or quarries, but they'd be low-lying places near streams or gullies that were very deep, and trash was discarded in those, and until it reached the height of the surrounding ground, these are areas that couldn't be used for agriculture, and so they became dumping sites. Unfortunately, the waste continued to lay there, and they influence water comes in through the cover. About 50% of annual precipitation infiltrates through an earthen cover, which is supposed to be covered with 18 inches of compacted earth, but I've been told by some that they know of landfills that may have only as much as 6 inches of compacted earth over the cover. So at least 50% of annual precipitation. How much do you think that we get as annual precipitation on average in Illinois?
I'd say about 40 inches, something like that. It comes by a certain pattern. It's changing some, but it used to be heavy in the spring, low in summer, drought, then rain again in the fall, that pattern.
Well, we get about 36 inches on average, 40 inches perhaps in some areas, and so about half of that rainfall infiltrates through the earthen cover, mixes with a waste, and forms a liquor that we call a leachate. And that leachate, unfortunately, leaks out in through the sides of the landfill and often down, so it can go both laterally and vertically. And we don't, since so many of these landfills were very old, nobody thought to put in groundwater monitoring wells to see if there was contamination that might go into the shallow or deep aquifers.
Even with mining, even today, there's suggestion that aquifer water that's rather pure can be used to wash coal, and then the tailings drop down a retired mine. So they drop right into the aquifer areas, and that's not very healthy. I also wanted to say that these days when you are getting rid of hazardous wastes, the federal government usually has landfills in places like Kansas where the scungy materials are deposited in a manner that you know where they are and what they are, so you have a much better idea of knowing what is leaking and how. So improvements have been made. I had another question, was where does the soil come from to go on to the top of the, a landfill?
Well, that was you're reaching back into history, Dave, and that was a problem with these old landfills, is that they would frequently put in 6 inches of daily cover on the old landfills that were of the 1970s, sanitary landfills, and they were required to put on a 6-inch daily cover, and they didn't do a very good job oftentimes of managing the soil. So when it came time to put a final cover on the landfill, they didn't have any more soil. And so they'd get it from wherever they could. And that accounts for why we have such a thin cap. And getting back to the thin cap, and I mentioned that these landfills are supposed to have a minimum of 18 inches of compacted earth. What do you think the depth of frost penetration might be in Illinois, in about this area?
Yeah, the frozen soil would probably freeze down to about 2 feet.
That's right. So the cover that's put on these earthen landfills, or the earthen cover that's on the landfills, is subject to freezing and thawing, shrinking and swelling, and that degrades the compaction that was made in trying to reduce the infiltration through the cover. And that allows the water to get into the waste, mix with the waste, decompose some of the putrescibles, the organic materials, that break down, and since they reduce volume, they help to create depressions. And so whereas the landfill might have been fitted with a dome-type cover at the end, now with the loss of volume because of decomposition, now it's like a failed cake where you have a depression in the top that instead of shedding the water, is collecting the water. Oh, my. So this is part of the sad problem of old landfills.
Yes, and if you want to bring in soil, you have to bring in soil that is rather rich soil for agriculture. So it's very expensive to do a cover of 2 or 3 feet. It's almost impossible.
Yes, and soil comes from various sources to do that, but it means digging a pit someplace else. Let me pose another question to you. We know that there's the nearest Superfund site to this area is the Hagler Zinc Superfund site in Danville. How many violations of the Safe Drinking Water Act do you think might have occurred here lately, say in 2015?
I would guess at thousands, but I have familiarity with Clinton. There's right on the landfill is right on top of aquifer.
Well, I was thinking of Champaign County, and I was surprised to do a little digging on this and found that in Champaign County, the Safe Drinking Water Act had violations of over 5,780 2015, most of those having to do with chloroform in the Sangamon Valley Public Water District. There's a number of places in
chloroforms
Illinois.
Chloroforms or
coliforms? Coliform.
These are bacteria.
Yes, sir.
And they are an indication of fecal waste.
You have that. You understand that correctly. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that I had kind of discovered in doing a little reading is that about a quarter of humanity worldwide faces high water stress, either from contaminated water or a lack of water. And one of the 17 countries that are facing a crisis is the United States. Do you know of any communities in Illinois that are currently facing water crisis?
Yes. David and I were at a meeting at Weldon not too long ago, and their wells over the Mahomet Aquifer were drying up because Decatur to the south was drawing water, and they're probably outside the aquifer area, but near it enough to pipe water to Decatur. So yes, we are familiar with areas where the aquifers are drying up, and that's a serious situation around the world. This is especially so if you have people that are going to use artificial milk where they need to combine it with water, and the water is not pure. So at the moment, Nestle's is being asked to provide to encourage breastfeeding rather than having milk supplies mixed with water that's impure. But that goes on with other things too. If you have products that need to be watered, you need to have purification of that water. And the purification doesn't always take out, it takes out the gross problems. It doesn't take out the subtleties, and some of these subtleties are very, very minor. They're catalysts, and so you don't need much of them to do damage in your brain or the rest of your body.
That's very true, David. Filtration systems do a pretty good job of capturing or stopping some of the inorganic and many of the organic chemicals, but we've lately learned at conferences that these carbon filters filter out all of the organic contaminants. And some of them, like the polyfluorinated alkyl substances, evade the carbon filters and can get, you know, continue on in the water that we drink. So some of these materials, like, you know, with Teflon and the flame-proof baby clothing. And the Scotch Guard that we put on carpets and so forth find their way into landfills, including the old unlined, thinly covered landfills, and this is where a source of concern. Let me ask another question: how many landfills do you think are regularly inspected?
Not very many. I know of landfills that range from about 50 acres to 9 acres or small, and you have to wonder whether they've got test wells around them where people can check the leachate. I would think there would be quite a few, and I would assume that many of them are not maintained. They're enjoyed by people to some extent because that vegetation is allowed to grow on them. And so at the meeting I was at, the Audubon people were saying this little 9-acre plot is also a place where you can find butterflies and birds. And so they're not regarded as scungy, but they are.
Well, yes, you've touched on a number of issues. And when I submitted a Freedom of Information Act to the Illinois EPA some years back, I asked them how many landfills in Illinois are regularly inspected. And I was surprised to learn that they don't keep a track of this, and that they knew that there were 44 active landfills in Illinois, and they were certain that those were inspected. And there's a number of old landfills, and then some delegated counties have landfill inspectors that go out and do inspections. So we don't really know, but it's only a fraction, a very small fraction, of the 3,430 landfills in the state of Illinois are inspected.
You don't know what the quality of the inspection is. Do you run in with a truck and run around for a little while and then disappear, or do you go to wells and take out the chemicals and take them back to a laboratory and really check them out?
Well, I actually accompanied inspectors on some of the as they did their periodic inspections, and all of the inspectors, or most that I ran into, try to do a good job. They assemble information before they go out. These are paper forms. And they'll review a little bit about the landfill that they're going to. But when they get out to the landfill, basically what they do is that they walk around with a blank sheet of paper or a blank form and a camera. And they'll spend anywhere from an hour to the very most an hour and a half, but usually about an hour walking around the landfill looking for defects. Now, unfortunately, when they get there, what they find is vegetation that amounts.
Invasive vegetation, like locust trees or cherry trees or autobiobs.
Just all types of invasive species, Phragmites and so forth. And the height of this vegetation is at least as high as some of the inspectors, and sometimes higher. So walking around through the weeds and trying to figure out not only where you're at, but what are you looking at over the areas of the landfill that you can actually walk across, traverse. Some of the areas are covered with, are too steep or too much covered with brambles or brush that are inaccessible. And they may be wetland areas that you find there. But no, they don't take any water samples that I'm aware of, but they do try to take note of whatever they can see. And unfortunately, this is, we're limited because our eyes are only about 2 inches apart and about 5 feet from the ground. So that kind of gives us a very limited perspective. And what I've been promoting is the use of aerial photography and the widely available airborne LIDAR imagery, the laser scanning that helps to give a very good topographic record of what is on the ground that is much better than what we can see as we're walking around.
It's a little after half past, so I just wanted to jump in here and mention that you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and this is the Prairie Monk program here. And we're talking with Chris Storr. Dave is mainly talking with Chris Storr, who's retired from the Illinois State Geological Survey, which is now part of the something Prairie.
The Prairie Research Institute at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
There you go. And I will tell you that Chris and I worked together. I did IT, as they call it now, left 26 years ago, so it was good to run into him again. So you've mentioned that it can be hard to see the ground when the stuff that's been growing is as tall as the people doing the looking. Do you know if anyone has ever considered doing a prescribed burn to get rid of any of this stuff, especially if you're especially concerned that there is actually leachate in a particular area? This particular landfill really needs a better inspection.
Well, that's a very interesting issue that you brought up, and when water infiltrates through the cover, it mixes with some of the putrescible waste, the organic waste, and part of the decomposition process generates a lot of carbon dioxide and methane gas because the landfills are mostly aerobic, and they have a small water table in them, and so that keeps allows bacteria that occur naturally to digest the organic materials, and give off this methane, which occasionally people will go out on the landfill and they'll demonstrate that they can strike a match and hold it near a little leachate spring, and it'll kind of emit a little bit of, it'll flame up a little bit. Yes.
No further questions.
Well, one of the ways of looking at this is it's called remote sensing.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell us a little bit more about it. You can sense with infrared as well as other wavelengths, and you can change the color, so you can check to see whether elm trees are here or beech trees are here or locust trees are somewhere else.
Yes, Dave. You've raised a very interesting part of the research work that I did. And that is, and I bought my research from the university, and I'm trying to help make this available to communities and to governments to use this technology. Way back when we used to fly aerial photography, at first it was just black and white photography because the chemical, we had... that was the extent of technology, but when color photography was came into use, the military started looking at other wavelengths, including the near infrared, which is just past the red, visible red, and what they discovered was that they could easily identify where camouflage was in the old days, so that if there was camouflage over an artillery installation, they could identify that with the color infrared photography. And so this became known as camouflage detection film. And now, some of the folks that did this were in military intelligence, and they were geographers and geologists, and they also noticed that they could find a lot of other things with this.
Yes, if you can find a dead car, for instance, it will show up.
Or diseased trees or vegetation stress of any kind. It became very heavily used in finding oil in doing certain types of geologic mapping. So the color infrared image photography was very highly sought after, but it was also required either to have a second camera in the plane or a special film. And this was so expensive that it was wasn't used very often for civilian use. However, not so very long ago, they stopped using film for aerial photography, and instead are now using a $1.1 million digital mapping camera that has multiple lenses on it, a panchromatic lens, a lens for blue, green, and red visible wavelengths, but also another lens that records the near-infrared. So what was once a very exotic form of aerial photography is now very commonly recorded. And when we contract for aerial photography in counties and by the USDA, they use this for crop compliance. The Department of Transportation uses this for their highway planning and environmental studies done for all of that. We now have four-band photography that we can use. And another interesting thing that's done is that we used to get individual frames of photography. Now, thanks to computer processing and analytic photogrammetry, which incidentally was one of the things that was developed here at the University of Illinois by the late, great Professor Hussam Carrara. He was not the only one, but he was one of the leading figures in this. We can now ortho-rectify the photography. That means take out all of the radial displacement and distortion and tip and tilt and make a photograph that is actually a map that's georeferenced. So not only do we have the beautiful photography in four bands, but it is already georeferenced so that we can use it as a map.
And then you can go to it with subtlety, with going back to Wolfram and Mathematica. You can take the subtleties and apply algorithms to them and gradually get to be looking at very detailed information.
Yes, Dave. And that was part of my work, was to use common image processing techniques such as unsupervised classification, use the LIDAR to find depressions, use band ratioing to find gullies and leachate seeps and vegetation stress. So these are things that can be seen very easily from an aerial photograph, but are not so easily recognized when you're on the ground trying to fight vegetation, tiggers, chicks, and trying to avoid stumbling around.
Yes, on a wet day with a bunch of cordgrass, which is quite a legitimate prairie plant, you can end up with a lot of scratched skin. It's rather uncomfortable to do that sort of thing on the ground.
Well, yes, and when you do this exercise, you know, you're borrowing from Arlo Guthrie Analysis Restaurant and marking up the digital image with the circles and arrows and the paragraph on the back of each one, you can now tie a database or a spreadsheet or a database to the aerial photo and track the defects on the landfill and then set a priority. Which ones do you look like ones that we want to we ought to be sure to check out? Which ones don't look so problematic, and we might check those if we have time, or just track those over from year to year, or so forth. And this is particularly helpful if we put this in the context of recognizing these old landfills as cemeteries of waste, and we are the caretakers, the sextons, the people who are responsible for taking care of these old landfills, not so much to protect the waste, but to protect ourselves from the leachate and the and that gets produced and prevent that from contaminating our water supply and streams.
How do you let the general public know about these sorts of skills? How do you transmit that information to the average citizen who probably does email but doesn't do a lot more than that? How do we bring together the technicians who know this sort of information with the people who are out there in everyday village life?
Well, that's a fair question. And the first tactic, the way that I've approached this, is to go to the people who do the inspections in the delegated counties and in the regulatory agencies and talk to them about using this technology. And they've been very slow to accept it. This amounts to quite a bit of work that they're not used to doing. Some of the folks have a little bit of training in some of this, in image processing and GIS, but quite a few do not. So this would require a professionalization of landfill inspectors that we've not yet seen. And that was proposed in the Senate bill by Senator Scott Bennett, and also supported by Representative Carol Ammons in the last General Assembly. Unfortunately, when the bill got to the House, that's when some of the lobbyists went to work on it, and the professionalization of the landfill inspection didn't make it into the final part of the bill. But we'll try to see if we can work on that and try to bring that back.
Is there a difference between different communities? I can remember the day when I heard a story of trucks taking waste material from the Chicago area to the Shawnee Forest area, and then they'd accidentally leave a faucet open and drive around the roads distributing this material. So when you do your mapping, do you find that areas like the Shawnee Forest are subject to dumping of that sort of loose style dumping?
Well, of course, this is the big legend of the Bliss family in Times Beach and in Missouri, where the dioxins were spread, mixed with waste oil and spread on the dirt roads that were in that small community. Often these were poor communities, or as you say, kind of someplace where no one might notice it right away. Or perhaps a farmer might not quite understand what he was accepting and allow somebody to dump something in a gully.
These people got sick.
Well, they certainly did. And in the case of the dioxin in Missouri, there were horses. Horse can weigh anywhere from nearly a ton, at least a half a ton. Very much heavier than a human being, and they got sick and died. So, some of these hazardous waste, industrial waste, were disposed of improperly. And I trying to keep track of all of these is something that I'd certainly hope and anticipate that regulatory authorities might do, but I will have to say that unfortunately, the regulatory authorities, primarily the Illinois EPA in this state, have had their funding cut. Not so very long ago, this was considered a cost-saving measure to help benefit the taxpayers and give them tax relief. But it does so at the expense of protecting our public health. And so I until funding is restored to these agencies, they're only able to do the limited amounts of work that they're legally required to do, and so it behooves us as citizens to encourage our elected officials at the state and federal level to restore funding and promote the good work that these regulatory agencies do.
Sometimes it's interesting that government cannot do some of the things you're suggesting because of the politics behind it. Then the locals get to be involved. 80% of our preservation is done by local people. I can remember that when some of the scungy material was going to Alabama, and it was coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was a woman called the Blonde Bombshell, and she would wait for the trucks to come in at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then she'd go videotape them. The question was whether she was going to survive, because this involved a lot of money. And she said, well, she's just so well known that if she were exterminated because of what she was doing, there would be a huge response to that. In other places, people have begun to count the number of and type of cancer results. Tell us more about this.
Well, thank you. And this gives me a chance to kind of pull out my soapbox and promote some of the good work that's going on in Champaign County. I've been fortunate enough to work with a few of the conservation groups like Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, the Upper Sangamon River Conservancy, and the Lincoln Heritage Resource Conservation and Development Group. And all of these groups have been very forward-thinking in recognizing that these old landfills pose a potential threat, if not in the extent of which we might not know, but they all pose a threat to the quality of our water, either as a surface water or groundwater. And they've endorsed the idea of what I call the stone soup approach to conservation on legacy landfills. There is no working. You pointed out that I'm a county board member, and let me reiterate something that I tell all of my constituents: there is no money. I've looked at the budget for the Champaign County, and we're trying very much just to meet our current obligations. So trying to find new money to do work to maintain these old landfills, which are some are publicly owned and some are privately owned and some are abandoned. And the conservation groups recognize that this is a particular need, and they all have some expertise, maybe not much money, but they all have some expertise, and that they can contribute to try to do spot repairs. We can't afford the $4 million it would take to recover 3 feet of earth and cover on an old landfill, but spot repairs are much less expensive. May require only a few truckloads of earth and the use of a backhoe to compact it, to do some grading, fill in depressions and gullies, and then remove in some way the invasive species and replant these with native species. This involves a good deal of conservation expertise in trying to get rid of undesirable vegetation or alien vegetation and get something that is more compatible, and make these into wonderful wildlife habitat that can be used for, somebody said, ottoman for bird watching, animal or hiking, just kind of taking a look at beautiful prairie flowers and maybe avoiding stepping on a quail or seeing a pheasant in flight.
Well, let me ask a question: is there a possibility that communities could be asked to sort their material so that it could be salvaged? Where the world is running out of sand, and glass is not going to be an invasive problem. So could we plant our glass in a certain portion of a landfill? There are other questions about mining old landfills. In some eras, you probably have platinum that goes with converters. We have a very small amount of platinum. Can cars be located in a certain place so that they could be salvaged for their platinum? So that means sorting. That means a responsible collection. Plastic can be collected. Hard plastic doesn't have research to say it can be worked at the moment. But plastic and research to know where you could plant stuff in your modern landfill. You don't have to send it to Kansas. You don't have to have a day when you collect everything and throw it in the same bin. You start to sort it out according to glass. And there's a reluctance to preserve glass at the moment because it's heavy, and there's a reluctance to preserve styrofoam because it's very light. But these processes help to define where the scungy stuff is, and so you can monitor it more effectively.
Well, you've touched on a number of issues, David, and as a kind of working in the solid waste field for so long, this is a controversial matter of public concern and discussion worldwide. India, in particular, is facing a great crisis of waste, and every developed community, every developed area is facing a problem with problems with plastic. It's one of the plastic bottles are one of the largest, most frequently found items that are found in rivers and beaches. And of course, these break down into microplastics that get swallowed by marine critters that work their way through the food system, and we may actually be ingesting some of these. At a conference here at the University of Illinois, a researcher showed that there were microplastics in the flesh of minnows. This is certainly something that each one of us can keep in mind and try to reuse, try to be environmentally minded in everything that we do, and this is where also where business people can try to devote their energies and attention to developing alternative uses or reuses for some of these materials, as you said, so that we can both reduce and reuse.
Yes, I've been suggesting that bars could use paper cups for beer. It's not very traditional. You like to see your beer. You like to see whether it's frothed on the top. But the paper can be recycled. The plastic that's often used is not so recyclable.
Well, that's one of the things that the waste community.